Welcome, Curious Minds, to another deep dive.
Great to be diving in.
Today, we're tackling diversity in the living world. Just imagine for a second you're exploring a rainforest, just teeming with life, or maybe peering through a microscope at these tiny, incredible things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just life everywhere, right? So the big question is, how do scientists even start to make sense of it all, this incredible variety?
That really is the core question. And understanding this sheer diversity is just so critical.
How so?
Well, for everything from, you know, protecting species that are endangered to finding new medicines, even just understanding our own place in the whole web of nature, it's like the foundation.
The absolute bedrock of biology.
Exactly. So our goal today really is to help you see the importance of every living thing, get a handle on this idea of biodiversity, and see how things are grouped and understood.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting right at the beginning. What is biodiversity?
Good place to start.
At its heart, it's basically the huge range of differences, the variety, among all living things in a specific area, not just counting species, but...
Right. It's more than just a number.
Yeah. It covers all the plants, animals, microbes, everything, differing in, well, size, shape, color, where they live, how they act.
Yeah.
You name it. It's this grand tapestry.
And it's not just pretty to look at, this variety. It's absolutely vital for, like, the planet's health.
How does that work?
Well, biodiversity keeps ecosystems stable and functioning. Think about pollination by insects or birds spreading seeds. That's interdependence.
Okay.
And that whole system provides us humans with stuff we need: food, medicine, clean air. It's the engine, really.
It's amazing to think people have been trying to figure this out for ages. Like Aristotle, way back, they called him the father of biology.
Mm-hmm. He was already trying to classify things systematically, laid the groundwork.
And then much later, Carl Linnaeus, he really shook things up with that binomial nomenclature, right? The two-part name.
Absolutely. That standardized everything globally. A huge leap.
Before that, it must have been chaos, trying to talk about the same animal or plant.
You can imagine. What's fascinating here is how they started grouping things based on shared characteristics, not just random labels.
Finding the common threads.
Exactly. And that basic idea, looking for shared traits to understand relationships, that's still how we approach it today, with millions and millions of species.
Right. Observation and seeing the patterns.
Precisely.
Okay, so we've got this idea of biodiversity and how we started classifying. Where do we begin breaking down all this variety? Let's start with plants. They're everywhere and so different.
Makes sense. Plants show incredible variation.
Scientists classify them based on, well, things like how tall they get, how strong their stems are, even leaf patterns, roots, seeds.
Lots of characteristics to look at.
Yeah. So height first. You've got herbs, shrubs, and trees. Herbs are the small ones, like coriander or wheat. Soft stems, usually pretty short.
Quick life cycles, often.
Right. Then shrubs, medium size, woody stems, kind of bushy. Think roses or lemon bushes.
Good examples.
And then trees, the big ones. Thick, woody trunks, branches way up high, making a canopy. Like a mango tree or a big oak.
And these different heights and forms aren't just random. They reflect different ways of capturing sunlight and getting resources. A tree invests in height. An herb grows fast.
It helps us understand how they're adapted, how they fit into their environments.
Exactly. It's all about strategy.
And sometimes the stem itself dictates how they grow. Some plants have really weak stems.
Right. They can't stand up on their own.
So they become creepers, growing along the ground like strawberries.
Shredding out horizontally.
Or climbers, like cucumbers or peas. They use supports, tendrils, whatever, to grow upwards towards the light.
Which is a clever way to get sunlight without needing a massive, strong trunk like a tree. They use what's around them.
Very resourceful. Okay, what about leaves? The veins.
Yeah.
Venation, right?
Mm-hmm. Venation, another great classification tool.
Two main types.
Yep. Reticulate, which looks like a net. Veins branching all over. You see that in plants like roses, dicots generally. And then parallel venation. The veins run side by side, parallel. Think grass or a banana leaf. Monocots.
Interesting. And that tells us more than just identification.
Oh, yeah. Those patterns relate to leaf structure and function. Reticulate gives broadleaf support. Parallel is efficient for long, narrow leaves. It's all linked to their overall structure and environment.
Okay, cool. Let's go underground. Roots.
Crucial part of the plant.
Two main systems here, too. Taproots and fibrous roots.
That's right.
So taproots, like a carrot, One big main root going deep down with smaller ones branching off.
Exactly. Common in dicots. Great for anchoring the plant securely and reaching water deep in the soil.
And fibrous roots.
Those are more like a mat, a cluster of thin, similar-sized roots spreading out near the surface. Think grass again, or sugarcane. Monocots often have these.
And they're good for it.
Really good at holding soil together, preventing erosion. Plus, they quickly soak up surface water. Different strategies again.
It really shows how they adapt deep water versus surface water, stability versus holding soil.
Precisely. Each system is a solution to environmental conditions.
Okay, one last plant classification bit. Sea leaves, cotyledons.
Ah, yes. Monocots and dicots. A fundamental split.
Monocots, single cotyledon. We've heard they usually have parallel veins and fibrous roots, like maize, rice, staple foods.
Correct. Very important agriculturally.
And dicots, two cotyledons, usually have the net-like veins, the taproot system, lots of fruits, veggies, legumes here, peas, mangoes, chickpeas.
That's the general pattern. This cotyledon difference is kind of a key that unlocks understanding a whole suite of other traits, leaves, roots, growth patterns. It ties a lot together.
Okay, plants covered. Now let's switch gears to animals. Just as much, maybe even more diversity there, right? Size, shape, movement.
Absolutely. An incredible range.
You know, it's funny how one animal can have totally different names depending on where you are. Shows that local
It
connection.
does. And beyond names, a really core thing for animals is their diet. What they eat is fundamental.
Right. Herbivores, carnivores, omnivores.
Right. Exactly. Plant eaters, meat or insect eaters, or those that eat both, it dictates so much about their lifestyle, their role in the ecosystem. It's how they interact with their environment for energy.
And how they move. That's super diverse too. Reflects their bodies, where they live. I mean,
Definitely.
you've got walking goats, us, lions, then jumping kangaroos, frogs,
Huge leaps.
flying birds, flies, bees, swimming fish, whales, crawling crabs, caterpillars, climbing monkeys, squirrels.
And each method uses specific body parts perfectly adapted. Think of a fish's streamlined shape and fins.
Or kangaroos' legs.
Precisely. Form fits function perfectly tailored for movement in their specific environment.
Speaking of diversity, fact flash,
Yeah.
did you know there are over 300,000 known species of beetles?
Wow.
Makes them the biggest group of insects by far. Just puts the scale of it all into perspective.
It really does. Mind-boggling numbers.
So what does this all mean? All this variety in plants and animals?
Well, it points to a basic need. Every living thing needs food, shelter, resources from its surroundings.
Which brings us to habitats.
Exactly. The habitat is just the natural place where an organism lives and gets everything it needs to thrive. It's home address, basically.
And these habitats aren't just backgrounds, are they?
Not at all. They actively shape the biodiversity of an area. What lives where depends entirely on the habitat. That's why preserving habitats is so crucial for protecting biodiversity itself. It's essential for life on Earth.
And inside these habitats, organisms develop
Yes.
adaptations.
Yes. Adaptation. It's the key to survival, the ability to adjust, to change over time, to thrive in a specific place.
How's that happen?
It can involve changes to physical features, behaviors, even movements, anything that makes the organism better suited to its environment. It's evolution in action.
Life finding solutions.
That's a great way to put it. We see changes in the body itself, like think of a camel's hump storing fat for desert life,
Okay.
or changes in behavior, polar bears hibernating through the harsh winter,
Right, conserving energy.
or even changes in location, birds migrating thousands of miles to find better conditions.
All strategies to cope with challenges.
Exactly, overcoming environmental hurdles.
Okay, let's dive deeper into some specific habitats and see these adaptations play out. Deserts first, super harsh, right? Extreme heat, sometimes cold, very little rain.
A tough place to live,
Yeah.
but life is resilient.
Like the cactus, a classic desert survivor. Those spines, they're actually modified leaves.
That's right, minimizes water loss and protects against being eaten. Pretty clever.
And the stem is green and spongy.
Yep, stores water and does the photosynthesis since the leaves aren't doing it. Plus, they often have incredibly long roots to tap into deep underground water.
Amazing. And then the camel, the iconic desert animal.
Truly remarkable adaptations.
Like their color blending in,
Yep.
long eyelashes and nostrils they can close against sand.
Essential in sandstorms.
And the hump. Okay, correction time. It doesn't store liquid water, does it?
No, that's a common misconception. It stores fat, but when that fat is broken down, it releases energy and metabolic water. So it's an energy and water reserve, just not liquid water itself.
Got it. Fat for fuel and water. Plus, long legs to keep off the hot sand, wide feet so they don't sink.
And incredible water conservation. They hardly sweat, produce very dry dung and minimal urine. Low breathing rate, too, all to save water.
They can drink huge amounts when they find water, right? And eat thorny plants.
Mm-hmm. Thick lips let them eat cacti without injury. Every part of them seems adapted for desert life. It's incredible.
Even camels in colder places like Ladakh are different. Shorter legs, two humps, thick hair.
Yes. Adaptations vary even within a species depending on the specific environment. Shows how finely tuned these treats can be.
Okay. From hot deserts to cold mountains. Freezing temperatures, snow, wind. Another tough one.
Very challenging. But mountain plants have their own tricks.
Like pine trees, fir trees, that conical shape.
Perfect for shedding snow so branches don't break. Tall growth helps too. Plus, thick bark for insulation.
And needle-like leaves.
Yep. Often waxy too. Reduces water loss, which can be an issue even in cold places, and stops snow piling up. They have cones instead of flowers to protect seeds from the cold. And they're often evergreen, right? So they can photosynthesize whenever possible.
Exactly. Always ready to capture any available sunlight.
What's fascinating here is seeing plants like rhododendrons adapt differently.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned they're shorter in windy places like the Nilgiris, but taller where it's calmer, like Sikkim.
Shows that adaptability again.
It really does.
And mountain animals. Thick fur, layers of fat, like yaks, polar bears.
Essential for insulation, retaining body heat in the freezing cold.
Their feet are adapted too. Mountain goats have grippy hooves.
Incredible grip. Rubbery pads on strong hooves. Polar bears have padded feet for walking on snow and ice, helps with grip and silence.
How do they eat? Yaks use horns to dig for grass under snow.
They do. And camouflage is huge. Snow leopards, mountain goats, their white or patterned fur blends right in with the snow and rocks.
Helps them hide from predators or sneak up on prey.
Absolutely vital. The snow leopard, for instance, with its thick coat, camouflage, and that long tail for balance and warmth. It's perfectly equipped. Yaks with their dense fur and horns. Mountain goats leaping across cliffs, masters of their domain.
Incredible. Okay, let's move to water. Freshwater ponds, lakes, rivers. Different challenges here, like currents, changing water levels.
Mm-hmm. Plants here adapt differently again.
The roots are often smaller, since water's everywhere.
Right, reduced roots, mainly for anchoring rather than deep water absorption. Stems are often long, hollow, flexible.
So they can bend with the current.
Exactly, and leaves vary. Submerged ones like hydrilla might be thin ribbons to reduce drag. Floating ones like water lilies are broad, maybe waxy, to float and shed water.
And they float because of air spaces.
Often, yes. Air spaces in stems or leaves provide buoyancy. It's all about getting sunlight for photosynthesis and surviving the water conditions.
And freshwater animals. Fish are the obvious example. Streamlined body, fins, gills.
The classic aquatic design. Gills extract oxygen from water. Fins steer, streamlined shape cuts through water easily, scales and mucus for protection.
What about frogs? They live in both worlds.
They do. Webbed feet for swimming, lungs for breathing air, but also moist skin to absorb oxygen underwater dual respiration.
Plus strong legs for jumping and that super fast sticky tongue.
Perfect for catching insects. They bridge the gap between water and land beautifully. If we connect this to the bigger picture, all these features let them navigate, breathe, and eat effectively in their watery or semi-watery homes.
From ponds to the big blue, oceans and seas, salty water, huge pressure deep down, less oxygen sometimes.
A whole different set of challenges.
Marine plants are mostly algae, right? Phytoplankton, tiny floaters.
Yeah, the base of the marine food web. Floating near the surface, doing photosynthesis, then you have larger seaweeds.
They need to anchor themselves.
They use holdfasts, like roots, but just for anchoring. Their fronds are flexible to move with waves. Some have air sacs to float upwards towards light. And crucially, they have ways to deal with all that salt.
Salt tolerance is key. Okay, marine animals.
Yeah.
Besides fish, what else is cool?
Oh, lots. Marine mammals, dolphins, whales, ocean superheroes. They live in water but need air.
So they have blowholes on top.
Exactly. For quick breaths at the surface, plus blubber for warmth and energy and that streamlined shape.
And mollusks, snails, clams. The ones with shells.
Animals with shells. That shell is like armor, protecting them from predators and pounding waves.
Sea anemones.
Yeah.
Look like flowers, but they're hunters.
Flowery hunters. Those tentacles have tiny stingers to catch prey that bumps into them.
And deep sea animals.
Yeah.
The really weird ones.
Lights in the dark. Many have bioluminescence. They make their own light.
Why?
To find mates, lure prey, maybe startle predators. It's essential in total darkness. All these are solutions to the ocean's unique pressures. Salt, depth, darkness.
Just amazing. You know, another fact flash. Some plants, like the Venus flytrap, are actually carnivores. They eat insects.
That's right. Adaptation takes many strange turns.
And speaking of weird adaptations, a chameleon's tongue is twice as long as its body.
Incredible reach. Just shows the specialization possible.
One more correction people sometimes get wrong. Thinking all plants need direct sun.
Ah, yes. Correction. Many plants, especially on forest floors, are adapted to and thrive in shade or indirect light. They've specialized.
Wow, okay. We've covered so much ground and water. What an incredible journey through life's diversity.
It really is astounding.
We've looked at the sheer variety, from tiny microbes to huge trees, how everything is classified, plants by structure, animals by diet and movement, and importantly, how everything is uniquely adapted to survive.
From deserts and mountains to rivers and deep oceans.
We saw how cacti and camels conquer the desert, how pines and yaks handle the mountains, how water lilies and frogs thrive in fresh water, and whales and deep sea fish master the ocean.
And the central message really is how interconnected everything is. Plants, animals, their habitats, it all works together. That really highlights why we need to conserve these habitats and protect biodiversity.
So efforts like reducing deforestation, cutting pollution, stopping habitat destruction, they're not just nice ideas.
No, they're absolutely vital. We need that diversity to keep the planet's ecosystems healthy and balanced. It's essential for our own survival, too, ultimately.
So, reflecting on all this, what stands out to you about these incredible ways life finds to thrive, even in the toughest places? And maybe, how can understanding these amazing adaptations inspire us, you know, really motivate us to protect this precious diversity for the future?
That's the key question to ponder. How does this knowledge change how we act?